From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1990 in a laboratory at UC Berkeley. Researchers discovered the first evidence of a gene involved in breast cancer susceptibility. And over the next several years, teams around the world worked to nail down the actual gene. In 1994, the gene was cloned by scientists at the University of Utah, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and at Myriad Genetics. And since then, we've learned a lot about the BRCA gene. I think they say BRCA, but look, I'm not even in that world, and I've got a lot to learn this hour myself. And researchers have been able to identify hundreds of mutations in the gene. Many of those mutations are linked to an increased risk of cancer. And the question for patients with this gene is, what can be done and what should be done? This hour, we work through your questions as best we can about breast care, including everything from preventive mastectomy to insurance. I'm going to welcome my guests for the hour. And there is a family who is coming in to tell their story. I hope, an inspiring set of stories from this family. It starts with Aaron Peta, who had a preventive double mastectomy in 2013 after testing positive for the gene. Do you say BRCA? What do you say, Aaron?
BRCA.
BRCA. Okay. How are you, by the way?
I'm very good, thank you.
Yeah? Well, you look great, and it's great to have you. Thank you for being here. And Dale Axtell is Aaron's mother, also a breast cancer survivor. Dale, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Nancy Harder is Aaron's aunt and a breast cancer survivor. Nancy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
All right. So, Aaron, I want to start with you and kind of take us back to, well, let's do that. Before we do that, I've got to do a couple of things here. We do expect later this hour to bring in Dr. Lori Medeiros, who's the director of the Breast Care Center at Rochester General Hospital. So listeners, if you've got questions on this, we're going to try to answer them. And before we do that, let me bring in Megan Mack, the producer of Connections, because I almost forgot. It's the second last day of our spring membership campaign, and we open this morning a long, long way from the goal, Megan Mack.
Yes, we don't pop in a lot to ask you for your support, but since we are behind, it's really important today if you can give us a call and help continue to support programs like Connections and also the great work that's going on in our newsroom with Great Lakes Today reporter Veronica Volk, our health reporter Karen Shikurji, who I'm sure is listening closely to this hour. But today's a good day to step up and donate because not only is it our pledge drive, but it's also Evan Dawson's birthday. So call and pledge your support in his honor or in Karen DeWitt's honor, also her birthday.
I think this is the worst reason to pledge.
Why
I think there's
not?
So many better reasons.
I'm looking for connections.
Okay.
Ho-ho.
Okay.
Bad joke. Don't pledge in honor of my terrible comedy. Call 454-6300. You can donate online at WXXINews.org or also on the WXXI mobile app.
Thank you. Thank you, Megan Mack. And I hope if you're listening right now, you're probably, if you're listening now, a regular Connections listener. And most of our listeners are very loyal, but also not members. So please change that at WXXINews.org. All right, Aaron, let's go back to 2013 was your procedure. That's right?
Correct.
It's amazing to you that it's almost 4 years since then?
It really is. I have a hard time remembering how long ago it was.
Well, obviously, there is a lot that goes into this kind of a decision. When did you get a diagnosis? Kind of take me through understanding what BRCA is and how you understood about it and maybe your family history. What's the story here?
Well, my family had tested positive for the gene a few years prior to my surgery. It had come up that my cousin had gone through some testing, and when going through her familial history, they questioned the breast cancer that had already happened in our family at such a young age for my mom and some of her sisters. And so they ended up testing to determine that one of my aunts was BRCA positive. We are on the BRCA2 line. And so from there, it was once that entire generation had been tested, if our parent had tested positive, we were able to get tested ourselves to determine if we had the increased risk for breast and or ovarian cancer. So after knowing that that was an option, once my mother did test positive with the gene, it took me a couple of years to come around to being able to have the courage in order to test. But once I did so, it seemed like from there it kind of was a pretty easy decision for me to make to go forward with having the double mastectomy.
And when you think about the courage to go forward and test, what was holding you back?
I knew I was going to be positive.
I mean, it's simply as you didn't want to know?
A little bit, yeah. Like, anybody who knows our family knows that I am very much my mother's daughter. So, therefore...
Is that true, Dale?
Oh, I guess I'm guilty of that.
So, I can... I can relate in so many ways to your fear. I think everyone has family members or maybe have been through something themselves in their life where you think you know something, you kind of don't want to know because you know what that could lead to. So for you, you understood what was probably going to come if you had the BRCA gene. You had BRCA 2?
Correct.
I have no idea 1 and 2. Have you learned about that? Did you feel comfortable talking about the difference here?
The biggest thing I know is that the difference from my understanding is that people who are BRCA 1 positive tend to have a higher likelihood of ovarian cancer versus a little less for the breast cancer, where BRCA 2 is higher breast cancer, lower ovarian.
Let me bring in Dr. Lori Medeiros, the director of the Breast Center at Rochester General Hospital. Get right on that microphone. By the way, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great to have you. Great. Was that a pretty good description of BRCA 1 and 2?
Aaron's pretty much on top of it. Yeah.
Are we saying BRCA? I mean, is that the...
Yeah, so I think, you know, I've heard it everything, right? Like BRCA, you hear that a lot.
Okay.
Angelina Jolie gene, that seems to be prevalent in the media.
People really bring that up still, huh?
Yeah, people still refer to it that way. And I'm sure, Aaron, you've probably heard that, right?
Absolutely.
It was like right around the same time, I think.
Actually, she came out, I want to say, 1 or 2 days before my initial appointment with Dr. Medeiros of just a consultation to potentially go forward with the surgeries. So it was right out in the open.
What were you thinking at the time when that happened?
Honestly, it just made it a little bit easier so that as I moved forward with my decision, it was less educating I felt like I had to do. Like people kind of had heard of it, so it wasn't quite as out there when I expressed that my plan was to go forward with the double mastectomy. It was as if it was kind of already out there, so people understood that people do it and why they do it.
And that's a really important point because I hear that not infrequently. You know, I think this whole idea of testing and preventing breast cancer is so new. You know, and I'm sure you've heard this, Aaron, but I know that women have had various reactions. So, I mean, Angelina Jolie certainly had a lot of backlash with that. And, you know, part of that is who she is, I think. But, you know, there's an awful lot of people that still think we're doing something really extreme.
With the preventive mastectomy.
With the preventative, correct. And when you're talking about a really high risk of breast cancer, and so that can range anywhere depending on which study you want to go with, in between 40 to 80%, and, you know, not just for BRCA, but for a number of genes, then you're really looking down the barrel of something that has a really high likelihood of happening, you know? And we sure as heck wear seatbelts for less likelihood of a motor vehicle accident. You know, the big thing with this is that it's very emotional, right? And it's very personal. And so women will do anything along an entire spectrum. Mm-hmm. So we try not to steer anybody into anything that they're not ready for. Certainly for preventative purposes, the mastectomy really is the one that gives us the most prevention because that'll cut our risk down by about 90 to 99%, again, depending on which study you want to go with. There are medications that we can sometimes use. And then there's something called high-risk screening, which I think we should probably talk about. And that really has to do with increasing the frequency of how often we're looking at the breasts, both in terms of physical exam or imaging.
All right. So before we jump into that, I'll tell our listeners, if you've got questions about breast health and there's a lot of sort of a wide range we could talk about here. And Dr. Medeiros is a great person to ask. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Aaron, I know you say you didn't want to know because you knew what it would probably lead to. But once you got the confirmation that you have the gene, what was the decision-making process like? Did you go into that knowing, okay, if I have the gene, I'm going to do this? Or did you think there's still a lot for me to process here?
I think as soon as I got my genetic testing, I think I kind of knew that if it turned out positive, where my head was at and which direction I was going to go with it. And it just, as a couple months passed and I continued to think about it, it seemed like the obvious choice.
Okay. What were the reasons against it for you? Were there reasons against it that would make you think, look, I don't want to do this?
One of the big ones would just be, I mean, it's a game. You don't really know, is it? Am I doing this, undergoing major surgery for, you know, no specific reason, you know? Or, you know, I look at my mom and my aunts that went through the surgeries and, you know, I'm very lucky to say that they're all alive and healthy. And so if they were able to do it, there's no reason why I shouldn't be able to fight that fight if I needed to. But it just, to me, my main decision, part of one of my main decisions for choosing to do it was just based on my age and based on the age my mother was when she had breast cancer, where they generally say that the next generation tends to happen sometimes 10 years younger. And she was in her early 40s at the time of hers. And so I was approaching 30 and I did not yet have a family and knew that I wanted to be able to. And so to me, it was about getting ahead of it so that it didn't become a problem down the road when I was trying to get pregnant or have a small child or anything like that.
Okay, Dr. Medeiros?
Well, I just wanted to point out, I mean, Aaron, you said something to me that during that appointment that I thought was really, really powerful, you know, because often with really young women, you fight that battle a little bit. Like, I haven't had kids yet. Do I breastfeed? You know, how does this all work? And one of the things Aaron said was, I just want to make sure that I'm not pregnant and dealing with this question, you know, or worse, not here at all. And I mean, I thought that was a really powerful thing for somebody to say. And it was very mature. It was very well thought out. And, you know, as Aaron said, I mean, it was a few months. We don't generally just jump into this, you know, without a lot of thought. But I thought that was powerful, you know, because really that's really the gist of it, you know, is you never know, you know, and you never know if you're going to be in that percentage that doesn't get it, because it's certainly not 100%. But certainly fighting that battle is a lot harder than preventing it.
Right.
And Dr. Medeiros, Aaron mentioned that there's a concern that succeeding generations could have it earlier. Is that right?
Yeah, well, so generally for screening. So we generally start screening earlier because there's an idea that there's probably a latency phase, meaning a period where that cancer can be undetected for a little while. So that's why we start a little bit earlier for the screening. So 10 years is kind of what we look for, and that's true of many types of cancers. We start screening earlier than the youngest affected member with the idea of trying to pick it up earlier in the process. So it may not necessarily happen earlier. It's just that by the time it's detected, it's already been there usually for a little while. So what we're trying to do is catch it earlier.
So let me just hit the numbers before we kind of work through the rest of the family stories, because again, I hope that you look at this family and there's some inspiration here, that there's a lot of hope. These are three strong, healthy-looking women sitting here, breast cancer survivors, and then a double mastectomy patient, a preventive mastectomy patient, who looks like you're doing great, Aaron. So, but let's talk numbers here. So if you've got BRCA 1 or 2, and again, two different genes here, lots of mutations, but BRCA 1 or 2, your future likelihood of having breast cancer is roughly what, doctor?
Again, moving target,
yeah.
Because genetics, again, is a field that's evolving, you know, but if you look at the literature, it can be quoted as high as 80-85. So that's very high.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's a really difficult decision, you know, for people to, and I can't stress that enough. That family support is really important, you know, and I have been, admittedly, I have a skewed population. So when women come to see me, you know, it's a different, we're in a different kettle of fish than the average woman walking around. But, you know, I have had women that I've been monitoring for BRCA because there's certainly a whole cohort of women that prefer that and that have developed breast cancer. And so part of that counseling really is we can monitor. It doesn't guarantee we're going to find it early. So, and I think that's the thing that's really hard, I think, for most people to grasp, because the idea really is, well, if we're monitoring it, shouldn't we catch it early? And I've had the situation a couple of times already where, you know, we've been monitoring with mammograms and MRIs staggered every 6 months, and they're coming in for breast exams with me and with their gynecologist. And yet in that intervening time, they've developed what we call an interval breast cancer. So very common for people with gene mutations, you know, relative to the general population, and they'll just form these breast cancers. And two of them, you know, ended up with chemotherapy and the whole gambit, you know.
So even with 6 month checks.
Yeah, unfortunately. So it wasn't as if we caught it, you know, and, you know, technically, hopefully everything's going to be fine, you know. But the treatment was a lot more aggressive than I think what any of us had hoped for. in terms of catching something and just getting some surgery and being done with it, maybe a little radiation, you know? And that's really what the hope is when we do high-risk screening. When we're doing it, that screening is not preventative. And I can't stress that enough because I think we all know that. Women, we take kind of a sense of comfort in our mammogram in a way. It's like, okay, I did it, I'm done, and now I don't have to worry about it again. Your mammogram is not preventing breast cancer. Your mammogram is a snapshot in a moment of time of what's going on with your breast. If something is developing in between, so you're developing a lump or something else, you can't rely on that negative mammogram. And the most common question I get, even for women who don't have gene mutations, who come in and they have breast cancer, the first question is, how did this happen when my mammogram was normal last year? And when you think about it, every single woman who has breast cancer had a normal breast mammogram last year. That's just the definition of it, you know? So I think getting past that sense of security that we kind of all feel, I think, you know, when you go in and you get that mammogram, and just understanding that with this gene, there comes such an elevated level of risk that when you're talking about the emotional downside to this, because certainly that's an emotional decision, the emotional impact of following a mammogram or following an ultrasound or doing breast exams when you know you have this axe hanging over your head, you know, that's been verified by a gene mutation, that's not inconsequential. Right. And so you're no longer taking somebody off the street who's healthy and normal and doing their normal things and saying, OK, we're going to do a double mastectomy. You're taking somebody who's really, you know, looking down the barrel of every mammogram. OK, is this the one? Is this the one where they're going to tell me? And are they going to find it early? Or are they going to bring me back in and say, OK, now you need chemo and you need radiation and we don't know what the prognosis is? And I mean, that is not trivial. You know, and I think that gets lost, don't you agree, Erin, a little bit in that conversation?
Absolutely. I made it through my initial screening of my first mammogram and my first MRI, and I think that's part of what helped push me over the edge on making my decision because I was a mess waiting for the results and going through it. And
even in your late 20s, early 30s, you're sitting there going, well, I've got BRCA, and even one mammogram is giving me all the stress that this is going to be the one.
Yep.
Wow.
Absolutely.
And so, Dr. Medeiros, do you have patients who get diagnosed with BRCA then, who their first reaction is, I'm just going to do high risk screening.
Yeah.
High risk screening. Just do that for me.
Yep. I would say the majority, I mean, I think my role is really to kind of explain what, you know, the possible consequences are. But that's not something that you absorb in an hour visit. And it's maybe not something you absorb in one visit or three visits or six visits. It's a process, I think. And I would say there's maybe a subset of women that come in. And again, realizing that, you know, we're not yet testing people for BRCA that are normal, healthy, no family history. By and large, these women have already kind of been living with this idea of, okay, when is it going to be my turn, right? Because they've seen their mom go through it, and they've seen their sisters go through it, and they've seen their aunts go through it, you know? And so they've already got that sense of heightened awareness, if you will, or heightened scrutiny over this. So for a lot of them that we, you know, we find this gene and we say, yep, you have the gene and there's something we can do about it. There's a sense of relief and they're happy. They're like, great, because I've been saying all my life, you know, I just want to not deal with this. And then there's a group that sometimes comes in and, you know, we've tested them, but the family history isn't super significant. You know, like they maybe have somebody who's been diagnosed premenopausally, very early, or somebody with ovarian cancer, or something like that, where it's not such a strong family history. And so there's still that denial in the back of your mind that, you know, that there's really something going on here. Because after all, most breast cancer is not genetic, right? Most breast cancer is sporadic or just happens. And so for those women, I think that's a much more difficult transition because they're coming in with that denial of anything happening, as opposed to women who really have been waiting for that axe to fall for a while.
It sounds to me like you counsel BRCA patients into the surgery if you can. No?
I would say not really. I mean, if somebody asks, I have to really kind of keep my feeling out of it, right? Because I'm not the one living with this. At the end of the day, you know, Aaron's living with this, right? So Aaron's the one who's waking up and living with that. And she has to feel comfortable and secure in her decision and happy with her outcome, right? So there's really no advantage, you know, because life's not just about the medical piece of it, right? It's a lot about everything else that goes into it.
And quality of life is different for different people.
It is, right? And so if doing a mastectomy is going to make you have significant depression, body dysmorphic, it's going to, you know, you feel like it's going to end your marriage and you're never going to live with yourself, that's not the right choice for you. You know, it just isn't, right? So I would say if somebody asked me directly, you know, in a consultation, which I've had a few times, you know, look, if this was you, what would you do? I'll tell them what I would do, you know.
You do the preventative.
But, oh, if it was me, I would do the preventative all day long. But again, I see breast cancer every single day, right? So I have to, you know, this is what I do. I sit down with women all the time and give them hopefully better news, you know, and then every so often it's not such great news, you know, and that's a tough thing to see and to live through.
Well, and to go back to the numbers then, we talked about BRCA being an indicator of future possible breast cancer up to 80-85%. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean in the next year or 5 years, but for women who are going to live 70, 80, 90 years, mm-hmm. The risk continues throughout lifetime. It's not like if you get past 60, you're not likely to get it, right? I mean,
no,
if you have BRCA.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there is a point where it's, you know, it's hard to tease out. So when we're talking about those numbers, and the reason I'm saying that's a moving target is unfortunately breast cancer is really common, right? So teasing out the exact number that it's going to be is kind of hard. And then on the flip side, it's also kind of not important. Do you know what I mean? Because the reality is those odds are really important when we're trying to devise things for a population, right? So if you're saying it, 40% of the population is going to be affected by this. This treatment is worthwhile on a grand scheme. For an individual, you're either going to get it or you're not, right? You don't know if you're in that 80% or you're in that 20% ever, right? And it's the same thing with breast cancer because I get this a lot. What are my odds? How am I going to do? What's the prognosis? And the reality is for an individual, it's 50-50. You're either going to be in the good group or not the good group. And you can't make your decisions just based on those statistics, right?
So when you go from having BRCA, having a possible future breast cancer of 80 to 85%, to having a preventive mastectomy, the risk falls to 5% maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge impact.
Yeah. I'll be honest. A lot of the literature really looks more like, you know, 1, 2, 3%.
Wow.
I mean,
less than 5%.
Yeah. It's very small. We still monitor. You know, we still do physical exams once a year, you know. But what you're dealing with after a mastectomy, depending on the reconstruction, because again, that factors into what we do in terms of imaging or mm-hmm. you know, and that's a bit over, you know, beyond the scope of what we're talking about today. But you're still looking. You know, we don't ever just say, okay, everything is fine. But the likelihood is way low, you know. And so I think there's a great sense of comfort in that when you've been waiting for that to happen.
I guess so. Here's what I don't understand. You mentioned that there was a little bit of backlash with Angelina Jolie, maybe because it's Angelina
Jolie.
Right,
I think
that. But take her personality or whatever out of it. Why would there be backlash over this kind of a decision?
Well, so I'll ask Erin what she thinks about this too. But I mean, so my impression is, you know, and so I'm a woman in a largely male field, okay? So I think there is a little bit of this almost paternalistic sort of sense of how you're supposed to treat yourself and how women are supposed to react. So, for example, the debate between lumpectomy and mastectomy. Okay?
Let's do a little definition. What's the difference?
So lumpectomy is when we take part of the breast for treatment for breast cancer. Mastectomy is when we take all of the breast.
Okay.
All right. And it's very polarized. I mean, it's very interesting to see how people talk about this. Medically, no difference between the two. Okay, so you do one, you do the other, the survival is the same, it's going to be determined by the type of cancer, and there are indications where you absolutely do need a mastectomy, but by and large, you know, for an average smaller tumor that we find, lumpectomy is just as good. Are there other things that factor into that decision? Yes, there are, right? There's a woman's willingness to do radiation, to do monitoring, there's just the comfort of doing the breast exams and dealing with that. By and large, there seems to be a lot of consternation about increasing rates of mastectomy. And I'm going to come right out and say, you know, for breast cancer, I'm perfectly in favor of lumpectomy, okay?
For actual tumors.
For actual tumors.
Yeah.
But that being said, I have no problem with a mastectomy in somebody who's well counseled, because at the end of the day, I think we often overlook the emotional and long-term implications for these women in favor of what we think should be right. So I sit at conference. I just got back from one in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago where we were talking about this very issue. And, you know, one of the panelists said, well, you know, it's ridiculous. We spent all this time trying to come up with these things to save breasts, and women want to go with mastectomy. You know, we should really be looking at this with a quality measure. And the reality is, the quality measure is not which surgery you choose. The quality measure is, did you understand why you chose that surgery? You know, were you counseled? Was that your choice? Right? Because at the end of the day, I think it's a woman's choice to decide whether she wants to deal with the entire package, which is lumpectomy, which is the entire treatment package, or the entire treatment package is mastectomy. And there's no wrong choice here, because medically, we're doing the same thing, right? So when you translate that into preventative surgery, I think there's a lot of this, well, you're being forced into something because you're afraid. And I think you could make the argument that the opposite's true too. A lot of women are so paralyzed by what they see as the possible implications of a mastectomy in their personal lives that they don't make the decision that they want to make because they're afraid they're going to offend their husband, or they're going to offend their significant other, or their family members, or their friends are going to look at them differently, you know? So, you know, fear is a two-edged sword, you know, and I think it affects both ways. But I do think a lot of that is part of the backlash. And then I think there's maybe less awareness than there was before. You know, again, I think Angelina Jolie, I do credit her a lot for coming out and being that open about it. Because I think it does give more support to that idea that this is not some kind of radical, crazy thing that one person did. It's really something that a lot of women do, and you might not know about it, you know. But I think it gives support to these women, because in reality, it is a really courageous decision. And they're making that not only for themselves, but for their spouse and for their kids and for their future. And they deserve to be supported in that.
Well, what I want to do is let's get our only break of the hour. I've got a couple listener questions that are really good questions. We'll hit those. So Amanda, Sam, Alex, we'll hit your questions when we come back. And then we're going to hear Dale and Nancy's story as well. Aaron Peta, Dale Axtell, Nancy Harder, all related. Dale and Nancy, breast cancer survivors. Aaron Peta had a preventive double mastectomy in 2013. She's doing great. And Dr. Lori Medeiros is the director of the Breast Center at Rochester General Hospital. So we'll get more of your questions and more of their story when we come back from our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, lake levels, rising water, homes under threat, and Plan 2014. What's the reality about controlling the water, who's responsible, and what happens next? Then in our second hour, is Billy Joel the worst musical pop artist of all time? Slate posed the question. Their writer's a little curmudgeonly about it. He says yes, but we're going to talk about when we need to know what bad art is to understand good art. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Amanda wants to know, how often do patients who have tumors and have them removed get another one in the future? Dr. Medeiros.
So, good question, right? Really common question. Unfortunately, it really depends on what the tumor type is. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's certain tumor types that are more prone to coming back. Depends on the type of surgery as well. Average, low risk, you know, tumors that are well treated, you know, probably less than 10%. Depends, though, on how aggressive it is. You know, and when you're saying coming back, I think there's a difference between saying coming back in the breast and coming back elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so what we worry about in terms of survival is breast cancer coming back elsewhere, because the most common locations for metastases or travel of that breast cancer tend to be brain, liver, bone, right? So the risk of that changes based on the biology of the cancer. So we spend a lot of time when we do treatments, we target that not only to just the breast cancer name, but within that, there's subtypes and subtypes of the subtypes and pretty sophisticated tools that we've developed to be able to try to target therapy so that we avoid overtreating people, you know, and subjecting people to unnecessary complications that can come from some of these treatments while balancing the need to try to prevent recurrence.
Okay. Alex wanted to know, what percentage of women have BRCA?
So it depends on what you're, so again, hard to say in a vacuum. High-risk populations, so I think what you're asking really is, you know, who should be looking to be tested for this, right? So we ask a lot about Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. And, you know, that's not always obvious, especially if you have a family history that's European, you know, and that may have come in through the war, and there may have been, you know, some name changes and things and other, you know, political ramifications that might have hidden that information from you. So we're very interested in that because it's a population with a very high incidence of gene abnormality. Women who have a strong family history of breast cancer, of course, and what we're talking about when we say strong family history, because I get this a lot too, is on one side. So it's really important to know your mom's side and then your dad's side, because frequently we forget to ask about that, like what happened on dad's side. And let's face it, most guys don't they don't get into that as much as women do, you know. So
what?
Yeah, shocking.
Yeah.
But you know, that's really important information to have, especially for breast, right? So we'll often test people with a family history that might be a little further away than what we would consider on a maternal side, because you may not see that breast cancer manifest in the male. That being said, male breast cancer, really high red flag for a gene abnormality. So, you know, that's a big one. And then, you know, these cancer syndromes, right? So you start to see family histories with breast, pancreatic, ovarian, even some sarcomas, things like that. These are all things that you want to know about. So not only knowing about a breast cancer history, but other types of cancers as well, even if it doesn't seem obvious. Sometimes when you put that whole picture together, it may not be BRAC, but it may be one of the other gene mutations or one of the other syndromes that we look for that we test, you know? So when we test for gene mutations now, it's not just the one or the two. We also test for a whole host of others that we know of right now, and there'll be even more in the future.
Okay. Alex also wanted to know, can men have BRCA?
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I have a few in the practice, but they unfortunately present with breast cancer. So, again, it's that importance of figuring out the male lineage. So when we test somebody and they're BRCA positive, and these ladies know that, we test everybody. It's not just the sisters and the aunts. We test, you know, the brothers and the sons, you know, because that's important information to have.
And Sam wanted to know if the rates of breast cancer in men is changing at all, and if we know anything about that.
It's pretty uncommon. So, I mean, I think the last statistic I saw was, you know, about 1,600 men a year in the U.S. So that's not a ton considering what the population is. But we see it. The thing with men that's hard is that, you know, they're not getting mammograms. There's no screening test for this, right? So really what you're looking for is a mass, and usually most of them are non-tender. So tender breast masses in men often are something called gynecomastia, which is a benign condition. But any mass, really, you should get that checked out just to see what's going on, and especially one that's non-tender or that's growing or changing. That's really something that, you know, it really does need to be evaluated. I can tell you the guys who come in with benign and have had to go through a mammogram have a whole new appreciation for that.
Listeners, if you got more questions, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Number of listeners have already asked about insurance. Does insurance cover a preventive double mastectomy?
It does. We've never had an issue with that. And while you're talking about that, you know, the things to be aware of with insurance coverage, because a lot of women ask about, you know, whether this gene will be considered a pre-existing condition.
Yeah.
So if you look up GINA, or Genetic Non-Discrimination Act, it was passed a long time ago. They can't use that as a pre-existing condition.
Even with a new healthcare law?
For right now. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, healthcare is that's a whole other 3 hours, you know, but for right now, you know, it doesn't mean life insurance can't. So that's something to consider, you know, before you go through this is, you know, do you want to look into that for life insurance? But for health insurance, we haven't seen that be a problem. And yeah, interestingly, insurance not only covers preventative mastectomy, but they also cover surgeries for balancing for breast cancer. So, for example, if I do breast cancer surgery, which involves, you know, I not uncommonly couple a lumpectomy with a reduction, for example. And so the reduction will be covered and will reduce the other side, you know. So that's sometimes a good way when you have somebody who really has had problems with that in the past to kind of combine those treatments. Or women who've had a mastectomy and need a lift, or they need a reduction, they need whatever on the other side. Those are generally considered part of the part of the cancer surgery because they're part of balancing and long-term outcome.
All right, Erin, any issues with insurance for you? That everything go okay there?
Yeah, I didn't have any issues at all. In fact, I just recently signed up for life insurance in the past year, and that went through without any issues.
Okay.
As far as I know, I was still considered at the top level of...
Well, you should be. You had preventive double mastectomy.
So, I was certainly concerned that it would red flag me and raise my premiums and all that, but... They didn't seem to ask too many questions at all once they had the information that they had.
Okay. Before I ask your family members about their story, just one more for you. You know, Dr. Medeiros talked about how every patient's different. Every patient is going to view quality of life differently. There are different considerations about what family, friends might think. Some are worried about stigma or what reconstruction or not would be like. Others are not concerned about that at all. Were those considerations for you? Were you worried at all?
I definitely had some concerns, more just for intimacy, more than anything else, how that would be in my future with the changes and everything. But, I mean, luckily it hasn't been a huge issue for me over the years. And I was really lucky that I didn't have any negative feedback from anyone that I told. Everybody was really positive and really accepting and encouraging, which, unfortunately, not everybody has the kind of support system that I do that would be as understanding in such a big decision.
Sure. And have you had any friends or anybody around you just ask you about the procedure? Have you talked to anybody about, I'm sure people always have questions when eventually BRCA enters their life or just that idea.
Yeah. I mean, the friends that I've talked to, like when I discuss it, they're always very interested. They're always very interested to see the results, to know what it looks like. In that end, but I've kind of run into a couple of people here and there who know that it might be in their family, and you know, it's just education is a big part of it. But I mean, I have a couple of cousins who know that they're BRCA positive who have not chosen to do any surgeries yet. So I mean, certainly I support them in that decision just as much as they supported me in mine.
Are they getting regular testing, I assume?
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, as Dr. Medeiros said, everyone's different in that. And you heard Erin say earlier this hour that even that first mammogram after you get tested positive for the gene, it was like, that I'm not doing this for this long.
Absolutely.
Some people will say, sure, yeah, I'd rather do it that way. But to each their own. And I want to ask Dale and Nancy their story. Dale, your breast cancer story, tell me about that.
Yeah, when I found out that I had breast cancer, there was no family history. And, you know, less than 20 years later, there's a lot of family history here, just from all three of my sisters.
Wow.
And my brother does have the BRCA2 gene as well, so he stays on top of that as well. But just knowing, and doctor here, I don't remember your name.
Dr. Medeiros.
Dr. Medeiros, you know, talks about percentages and stuff. And 18 years ago, yeah, there was percentages out there. But it's just information that really helps you with your decision. And from me to the next sister that was diagnosed with cancer to the next sister, all that information and all that staying on top of things does make a difference. It made a difference in treatment for everybody. To the last sister that was diagnosed was my twin sister, and it was very small. Her treatment was not like everybody else's. And first thing I say to anybody when we start getting into the conversation, wow, you and your sisters have all had breast cancer. I go, yeah, but we're all doing great. I mean, that's the next thing I say, and then, you know, if they want a little more history, then we can go on from there. For my generation, the BRCA2 really wasn't part of the conversation at all.
Yeah.
It was not part of the conversation. So that's different. That's more you got to go on for information. And
Dr. Medeiros, just a little on the history then of not only BRCA, which kind of goes back to the early 90s, the discovery. When do we really start seeing preventative mastectomy as a real option?
I mean, I think it's always been there. It's not like this is something that's new, certainly.
Not just with BRCA.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with BRCA or without, I mean, there's other things that will increase risk. But I think you start to see a lot more of it once people started coming forward with their story. So, you know, Angelina Jolie was the most recent bombshell, but I mean, there was lots before that. I believe Christina Applegate was another one, you know. I mean, this is not uncommon, right? So when you look at like a small little segment of the population like Hollywood is, I mean, that's a tiny little, you know, microcosm, and you start to see numerous people that have gone through that. That gives you kind of an idea of what's out there in the population. I think what's different is the awareness, right? So sometimes it's, you know, it's education on both levels. So it's education on the part of the person who's out there seeking care, but also the people who are treating them, right? So if that's not a main part of your, you know, of your reality or what you see, you may not necessarily default to that. And I've seen a big change. So we're very fortunate in Rochester, I have to say. So I moved up here from Connecticut in 2008 now, I think. And we do have a really informed and energetic group of people here who really make it their business to find out about this, right? So many of the GYNs and many of the primary care physicians that I work with actually will do this testing themselves in the office, you know, so it's not something that's hard to get. I mean, we have a genetic screening program with the Breast Center at RRH. But certainly there are multiple points of entry in the Rochester system. And I think that's something that's really, you know, it's really special about this area because clearly we can see those benefits and how that translates into improved outcomes.
And Doctor, I had an email from a listener named Gina who wanted to know what the genetics testing actually entails.
It's a blood test. So, I mean, there's a blood test, there's a sputum test. Generally, we do blood. And the way that generally works is there's now a number of different labs that will test for that. Generally, when you come in for the genetic counseling appointment, you'll meet with the counselor. They'll then go through what this means, what the outcomes are, what the potential ramifications are. The blood's generally drawn and held until insurance coverage is obtained, and you get an idea of what the copay is and that kind of thing, if there is that. And then the test, you know, is sent off. Generally, the turnaround times that we've been seeing for patients that I see that are surgically urgent, meaning somebody who's come in with a diagnosis of breast cancer and is wanting to know about this to figure out what they want to do with the other side, if they want to be doing something preventative at the same time of treatment, those we've seen turn around, we've sent them out and seen them turn around in about 10 days. That's the earliest. Generally, we quote about 3-4 weeks, though, you know, because these labs are centralized. They're getting, you know, data from everywhere, and sometimes it kind of depends on the time of the season, you know, when things are coming in. So, but certainly within a few weeks, you get those results, and then you kind of go from there.
Okay. Well, Dale and Nancy, are you the twins, by the way?
No.
You're not the twins, right?
No, we are not the twins.
Okay. All right. I just want to make sure that I wasn't looking at twins here.
No.
Because you said you're...
We have two other sisters.
Okay. And you're... And everyone in the family ends up with kind of a diagnosis here. So, Nancy, when was your diagnosis?
Well, my first diagnosis with breast cancer was in 2000, and it was treated with a lumpectomy, and we were not high risk. Like Dale said, there was nothing in our families, the generations before us, and at that point, our parents had both passed away. So we really didn't have any reason to have a genetic testing. 5 years later, the reason why I had the genetic testing is because my daughter was unable to get pregnant, and they wouldn't give her any kind of any estrogens or anything if I had the gene. And I had a 15% chance of having the gene, but we found out, and when I found out I did have the gene, that's when I decided I was going to go ahead and have the bilateral mastectomy. And when I was going through that, I found out I had breast cancer a second time.
Wow.
So very fortunate. I mean, a lot of things just fell into place. So fortunate for our family. We were very, very lucky to find out this information about our genes. And when I went to the doc, my oncologist just this past year, I says, you know, it's hitting our next generation now. What do we do? And his answer to me was, it's just a matter of time before they're going to get it. So being proactive, I was just so proud of Aaron for being so proactive to do this. And I have a daughter that has the gene, and I'll stay on her about, you know, what are you doing? And she is taking care of herself yearly and having her checkups. But I'm all for it.
Would you rather she get the surgery?
Yes, I would, because, I mean,
my daughter was home. She was the only daughter that was home when I was going through this, and she saw me going through the chemo. She saw me going through the radiation. So she has that memory in her. And so I know that she has it in the back of her head. She is the youngest one of all the nieces. And so she's, I think she believes she has time still to put this off a little bit. But I'm she's being proactive to the point where even though she's young, she's still getting her mammograms and ultrasounds.
Yeah. Do you get the sense just in conversation that, you know, over time she might change her mind and say, okay, you know, I'm getting to a point where I think this is the right time?
I think she will, yes. Yeah.
And to me, doesn't this say, Nancy, that whatever stigma is out there isn't really as much of a stigma as people fear? I mean, it just sounds, your family is so supportive of this. You're encouraging others to have it. You're hearing Dr. Medeiros talk about not only her personal view, but also being willing to help patients understand what certain things mean. I don't see a stigma to it, do you?
I don't, but I think that's easy for us because we have five siblings in our family. Four of us have the gene, and yes, our brother has the gene, and yes, he has gone through a mammogram, and we just, it's part of table talk. We just laugh about it. I agree.
All right, so what's going on with you now then? I mean, what kind of annual work do you need to do?
Well, I was told that because I have the BRCA gene, I do continue to have mammograms. I don't have ultrasounds or anything. I continue to have mammograms. But other than that, I see my oncologist once a year and very healthy and happy.
Yeah, you feel good?
Fantastic.
And do you, considering you have the BRCA gene, even though you've gone through two different cancer surgeries and the mastectomy, do you have any nerves about it? When you have that day where you get checked, do you have any concerns?
I don't worry about it anymore.
That's good.
I don't.
That's good. I mean, Dr. Medeiros, this is like the model family, isn't it? In many ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's there's not a small number of families like that have gone through this, you know. And I think what you said was important in that when you've seen the other side of this, what the treatment's like, it puts it in a different light, I think, you know, because certainly the surgery is not small, but the treatment's worse, mm-hmm. you know. So I think, you know, and maybe not even just from the standpoint of just side effects, just the emotional part of that, because, you know, I had a patient who said to me once that, you know, and I thought it was a good thing, it's like the monkey on your shoulder. Cancer, you know, because it never goes away. It never leaves your mind. It's never gone, you know. And even, you know, years later, it's still, was that headache something? Was it something I should get checked out? Okay, good, it's gone. You know, and I mean, there is that. It changes your life fundamentally, I think. And so there's that understanding of what that means, I think, when you've seen somebody go through this versus really when you're on the outside looking in. And you maybe haven't had that experience to be able to kind of, you know, contrast this with.
Well, down to our last couple of minutes. So, Doctor, let me kind of close the hour in a similar fashion to how we opened. We opened talking about 1990, the first discovery of evidence of a BRCA gene and how valuable that has been. And now going forward, what's the next big frontier in breast care? What do you think is the next hurdle to fall to make either Ooh. The surgeries easier detection? I mean, is there another?
For sure. I mean, so this is like an exciting field in that it changes all the time, right? So we change what we do. It drives people crazy sometimes because, you know, I'll have patients that I've seen and treated, and then 2 years later, we're doing something else. And a lot of it is as we get better at understanding what we're treating, right? Because this is really the crux of it, is understanding the biology, understanding what's driving these cancer genes. We get better at selecting things out and making these treatments smaller, mm-hmm. you know, and making the interventions smaller, and hopefully getting to a point where really we're doing very, very little here, you know, to get somebody back to their normal life. Because this is important, right? These are your mothers and your sisters and your wives. I mean, you know, so this is, it's a big deal for us, you know. So I think the big things in breast cancer right now, for surgery, really we're looking at trying to make things more minimally invasive. Certainly for imaging, I mean, we're all aware of what the controversies are with screening and that kind of thing. And I think that's a really good conversation because it's kind of it's proof of what we've been talking about for the last. It's nothing new in the medical community that, oh, we're worried about overtreating a certain population.
You're so disappointed I didn't bring it up
yeah,
this hour, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, but I think that's the thing, right? So now we know we're getting better at this. Who can we select out? You know, and so those are the next questions is how do we avoid doing more?
I'm amazed what medicine can do. I mean, I had a catheter ablation surgery for Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, this little tiny little heart thing, which was, you know, I say tiny, but it was an open heart surgery until sometime, I don't know, in the 1980s or 90s. Yeah. And here I am having an ablation, no scars, no nothing. And so maybe that, again, as you say, that's the future. Less invasive, more targeted. And it's amazing what medicine can do. And we've learned a lot this hour from Dr. Medeiros from Rochester General Hospital. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. And to all three of the women sharing their stories, Erin Peta, Dale Axtell, Nancy Harder, I really admire all of you. Here's to continued good health, and thank you for coming in and sharing your stories as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we're right back with you on Friday on Member Supported Public Radio.